Didn't they make an adult remake of it? And then what was that title, Jim? Do you remember the title of that one?
Sorest Rump.
No, to bang the drum slowly. I thought you had one.
Bang my mom slowly? I don't know.
Yeah, that's
I
what
can't
he sent him a text message, and so I replied back. Only
yeah,
is
that's what
it
I was.
okay?
That's what I was looking
Somebody
for.
asked me if I was going to be in a gay porn, what would it be called? And I said, Sorest Rump. That's the only thing I can come up with.
And that's when that's when your director yells at you. There's no crying in gay porn. No, just never. Okay. So
Or
what
that's like,
other besides that one,
pick
what
a
other?
title, pick a title of something, and I say that's the name of my sex tape, so you can say, yeah, bang the drum slowly.
Talking baseball, Klazuski Campanella, talking baseball, the man and Bobby Feller, the scooter, the barber and the nuke. They knew them all from Boston to Dubuque, especially Willie, Mickey and the Duke. Well, Casey was winning, Hank Aaron was beginning, one Robbie going out, one coming in. Kiner and Midget Goodell, the Thumper and Mel Parnell, and Ike was the only one winning down in Washington. I'm talking baseball, Klazuski Campanella, talking baseball, the man and Bobby Feller.
So this is frequent guest Brian Malik, and I'm taking over the podcast for this episode. Somewhere between Mike and Jim letting me in a hostage situation took place to get to this. Anyways, we're going to talk about my
favorite
sport.
One of us is crabby because the audio sucks.
Yeah, it's easy to talk Jim into it because he couldn't reply back to his audio. So anyways, we're going to fire up the hot stove and talk some 70s versus 80s baseball. That's going to be like a typical episode. We're not going to be afraid to conquer the controversial questions like who was the better manager, Morris Buttermaker or Lou Brown. We're also going to do a little different this time, breaking it up into innings. We're going to cover topics. We'll just call them innings. And we're going to get started with the first inning and the deep, dark, controversial question of, did your Little League baseball glove have an autograph in the palm? Jim, you're leading off this inning. When you had your first glove, did it have an autograph in the palm?
Yes, it did. And I can tell you who it was. I had two of them, and they both did. Would you like to know who they were? Is that
Please.
A different inning? Or?
Yeah.
Please, we got to
okay.
fill up.
The first one I had was the first one I had was George Brett, and then I had one that was Jim Rice.
Ooh.
How did you specifically try to find a Jim Rice one? Because we talked before about how you're a big fan of Jim Rice.
Yep, and it was not easy, and it was the wrong kind of glove for what I'm doing, but it was, you know, until I got the George Brett glove, the Jim Rice one had to suffice.
Well, how was it the wrong kind of glove? Was it like right-handed instead of left-handed, or?
I don't know. It was, you know, it had a small basket on it, and it was, excuse me, it wasn't an infielder's glove, it was an infielder, it was the wrong kind of glove. And so, we got the other one, and then I had two, and then it was fine.
Okay.
You have an outfielder glove, and it's got a huge basket on it, right?
Right,
yeah.
Right.
And then you get like a infielder's glove, and it has a smaller basket, so you can get the ball out faster. And, you know, I just was doing different things, and I had the wrong glove, so my dad bought me another one.
Yeah, yeah. You're known for your quick release, but even back then, Jim.
Are we talking to? Oh man, I can
yes,
go
we
totally
are.
Different places with that.
All right, so who's next?
Well, Mike, if you wanna bat second this inning and tell us about your Little League baseball glove and also any gloves you've had throughout the years, Jim, you can also pipe in if you've had more gloves since the ones you had when you were a kid.
My the one that I had got stolen out of my room at the Air Force Academy. I had it on the bookshelf and somebody walked right by, and in the dorms you could kind of keep your doors open. I don't know if it was like that in college or not, but in the door, you know, you was only like one or two guys in a dorm, so sometimes you'd leave them open, so it's just, you know, kind of an open area. And I went down to take a shower, and somebody walked by and took my glove right off my little bookshelf in there. I was so pissed off.
You would think the people wanting to serve our country would be a little bit classier than to steal someone. I mean, baseball guys, all the childhood memories wrapped up in that.
Yeah, I mean, that one was the one I had in high school, so it wasn't Well, it didn't go back that far, but still, you're absolutely right. And no, even at the academy, and I wasn't, I always make it clear that I was not a cadet, but, you know, it was, you'd think it was honor among thieves there, and there was not. If there was something and it was easy to take, they would take it.
When I was in college, we had the doors open to our dorms, and we bought a fancy stereo system that had a programmable remote control. So we went and programmed some of the other people's remote controls without them knowing it. Then we could walk up and down the hallway and turn people's TVs off or turn the volume up or down.
They had that at Normandale? Really?
Well, the other thing is they had that in the late 80s.
Yeah. It's too bad we don't have sound effects yet, because I could have played crickets after my last joke there, but at the Air Force Academy, it was two guys in a room. You had a bed and a bookshelf, and that was it. And you really not a lot of. You didn't even have a closet. That bookshelf thing was on the back side of a wardrobe.
I think you're mixing that up with prison again, Jim. But okay, let's get on to my.
Prison, they didn't. That was a whole different thing. We didn't have any of that shit.
All right, so you guys want to hear about my autograph glove?
Absolutely.
I'm interested to hear to see if you guys even remember this guy. I had George Foster.
Remember? Oh yeah, he was on the Big Red Machine, right, for the Cincinnati Reds.
Yep, and I looked him up. He played during our whole 70s to 80s. He played from 69 to 1986. Wow. He was a 5-time All-Star. He was a right-handed slugger that had 348 home runs. But I think most people remember him best from the baseball cards where it seemed like he was always squinting into the sun on every baseball card.
George Foster was the first one to make $1 million, right?
Was he?
Yeah, that's what I'm remembering. I'm looking it up now, but I thought he was the first millionaire.
Is that or Cal Ripken? I'm not sure.
Nope, it was way before that.
I didn't even know you guys would remember him, but yeah, I just remember he always had not a very attractive.
He played for the Mets too, I think.
Yep, he was mostly with the Reds and Mets. He played with four teams, and it was mostly the Reds and Mets.
Yeah. I remember that guy.
Yep.
Real skinny, tall guy.
Yeah.
Yep, I remember him. Can somebody look up that? My phone died. I wanted to look up that $1 million thing with the ICANN without turning myself off here.
We can look it up.
I'll look it up if
Mike, any other, other than your George Foster glove, any others?
No, that's the only one I think that really had a good autograph. I always wanted someone cool like George Brett or Kirby Puckett, but I had the old George Foster. So.
Nolan Ryan in 1980 was the first $1 million player when he signed a 4-year deal with the Houston Astros.
That sounds right.
I remember specifically going to a game to watch him pitch. He was in his late, or probably early to mid 40s, and to watch him warm up was just amazing. First, he was throwing a football around. He probably had a better arm than the Vikings quarterback at the time. And then watch him long toss before he'd start pitching. It was just amazing at his age. Because now it's like, okay, he's like younger.
Saw a story on him recently, and I think he got clocked. I think just recently he was clocked in like the low 90s or something.
That's just amazing.
Yeah.
So you had no fun autograph, people. George Foster was the pinnacle of your autograph gloves.
Yep, that's about it. Yep. How about you? Who'd you have, Brian?
So my story is the first glove I ever played catch with, the signature in the palm was Carl Yastrzemski, because it was my dad's.
Wow.
Yastrzemski, the 1967 Triple Crown winner and grandfather of, there's a Yastrzemski in the league now. I don't remember his name, but it's his grandkid. But it was for right-handed people. We've quickly learned that I was left-handed. So actually my first glove we went and bought at like Target or whatever before our first Little League game had no signature in it. I went on to have 3 more gloves in my entire life. I got one in 7th grade when I started playing 7th grade baseball. That had Nolan Ryan for the signature. Had that solid for years, relaced it, and then lost it at a softball tournament in Hastings. I'm still devastated to this day because that was like the best glove ever. Replaced it with the Ryan. I had bought a backup one. It was Ryan Sandberg, the second baseman from the Cubs. I wasn't a fan of his, but that was just the glove I bought to have a backup glove. And then when I lost the Nolan Ryan one, I got one. It was the day that Randy Moss had his three touchdown rookie performance at Lambeau Field. I bought it that day from a coworker who had gotten in an accident, was never going to play again, and that had Ken Griffey Jr. in the palms. So I had Nolan Ryan, Ryan Sandberg, and Ken Griffey Jr., and I still got the two gloves, the Ryan Sandberg and Griffey Jr. one, to this day.
Wow.
And they're broken in, and they're ready to go. In fact, I'm got in a softball league I'm going to be playing on Wednesday starting in the last week of April. So we'll see what my body reacts to that.
And that's what – no, but I just wanted to say one thing on gloves. Remember when we were kids, you had – kids today have it so lucky the gloves come and they're all broken in. Remember when we were kids, you had to have your dad back the Buick over it just to break it in? And
we grab it with rubber bands or duct tape or something and like sleep
and put it under your mattress. Yeah,
you'd put a ball.
That one you could set, the one I lost in Hastings, the Nolan Ryan signed one, you could drop a ball in it and it would just automatically flop over it. It's so broken in. Yeah, now they you can take it to Dick's Sporting Goods or someplace and they'll break it in for you. They have that you can pay an extra money and they'll do it for you, anything for a buck, I guess.
What I remember is Mike was right. It'd be like a quarter inch of untanned leather, and you'd put the ball in there and then wrap something around it, or actually you'd pour some sort of a linseed oil or whatever.
Yep, or neat's foot oil. Or
Yeah, and then put a ball in it and tie it up and leave it for a week.
Mm-hmm.
Or a winter. Pull it out in springtime.
When I bought the first backup glove after I had the Nolan Ryan one, I bought the Ryan Sandberg one. I think that took 3 years to get it broke into the way I halfway liked it. And now it's to the point where it's my regular glove, and I'm probably about 8-9 years to break in the Ken Griffey Jr. one.
Yeah.
All right. So should we call that the end of the first inning and go to the top of the second?
Yep.
Yeah. Who's winning?
So there's no winning in baseball.
Yeah.
So the second inning, I want to talk about, and we've talked about movies and their sequels before, so I want to talk about a movie and its two sequels, which came out the next 2 years. 1976's The Bad News Bears, which was 97% on Rotten Tomatoes. It's tied for the highest Rotten Tomatoes rating of any movie we're going to talk about tonight. And then the second one was The Bad News Bears 2 was Breaking Training. That was the next year, 1977. That had a 50% Rotten Tomatoes rating. And then in 1978, for Bad News Bears 3, Bad News Bears Go to Japan, that had a 6% Rotten Tomatoes rating. So obviously, we've talked sequels and how tough it is to keep it going, and sometimes the sequels are better when we talk Star Wars. Here, Bad News Bears is a fantastic movie. The other two are virtually unwatchable.
Who were the major stars in the second one? Because Walter Matthau left, right? He wasn't in the second one, was he?
No, it was William Devane took over his role, and he was, I don't know, he's kind of a bad guy from Murder, She Wrote. You'd recognize him.
I love William Devane. Love that guy.
You know who he is? Okay, yeah, he was like one of the actors on Marathon Man,
Exactly, I was going to say that. He's the guy in the car.
Yep.
Yep.
So he was in that, and then the third one was Tony Curtis from, I guess he was most known from Some Like It Hot. So I don't know why they didn't get Walter Matthau. I think if you don't get Walter Matthau, you don't make the next two. It's kind of my opinion, but.
Until it's just those, they're taking advantage of how good that first movie was and how well it hit.
Exactly right.
So what's more surprising, the 97%, which is really high for the first one, that's high for a comedy. Or 6%, which you hardly ever see movies get below in the single digits like that for the third one.
Yeah, it's got to be worse than like Howard the Duck and Ishtar and all those.
Ishtar. I'll be right back. Don't talk about me while I'm gone.
We'll try not to.
We don't talk about you when you're even here.
But Spring Breaking Training, the second one, that's the big deal about that was they went to the Astrodome, which was a new stadium at the time. And I guess
the Astrodome.
That was supposed to be a big deal. Like I suppose it was at the time, but now watching it, it's like, what's the.
It's terrible. It's
the concrete dome.
I can't believe that they played sports in that place. I mean. And we're going to talk, not to foreshadow later on in the podcast, but we will talk about dome stadiums versus playing outdoors. But in Houston, Texas, I mean, you got to think that a July day game, that would have been just unbearable to be inside that place.
Yeah, that's the one place that doesn't need an indoor. It doesn't rain there a ton. That's, I don't know why they had a dome there. So as far as the movies go, I mean, so the first one had Tatum O'Neal and that Jackie Earl Haley. He played the little motorcycle riding kid with the little grease ball.
Yep.
And so that had 97% rating. I think the problem with the sequels is whenever you have a kids movie and you do sequels, the kids start getting taller, kind of like Stranger Things on Netflix, and they start looking kind of goofy and stuff. They don't look like
kids. A prime example of that is the Christmas movie with that kid.
Ralphie?
Christmas Story?
No, the
oh, kid.
Oh, Home Alone.
Yes.
Macaulay Culkin.
Macaulay Culkin. Yeah. The first one was awesome. The second one was even pretty good. They made four of them. They made two more after that.
Wow.
After, you know, after Pesci and the other guy and Macaulay Culkin, after all those guys left, they made two more, and they are, talk about unwatchable.
Hmm.
Pretty bad. So I went and got my black glasses in honor of Walter Matthau.
All right. You should get some eye black on, too.
Oh. Well, or some, take the duct tape off them so you're not like Slapshot, and then be like Ricky Vaughn, which is also foreshadowing for another inning. All right, anyone else?
Eye black anymore.
Anything more to add about the Bad News Bears trilogy, or are you going to go on to the third inning?
Well, I don't know. Not much left to say about that one.
Yeah, I think we covered it pretty good.
So for the third inning, we're each going to share a memory or a story from the 1970s about baseball. And I have a very specific story I wanted to share, so that's why I picked this for the third inning. But let's have Mike, you can lead off in back-to-back innings.
Okay, well, I'll get the lead off twice. My 1970s memory is June 26, 1977. It was 90 degrees. It was Rod Carew Day at the old Met Stadium in Bloomington, Minnesota.
Remember the story?
Everybody got a jersey with number 29 on it, and they were pretty good jerseys for that back then. I mean, it had an ugly advertisement on the back, which I wish I could remember. But the Twins ended up winning 19-12. Remember, June 26th, that's the important thing. Rod Carew, through June, had gone 40 for 87, which was a 4.59 average. In the second inning, he got a hit, which put his average over 400 for the season, which was the latest. Again, June 26th was the latest anyone had done it since a little player called Ted Williams. The crowd went nuts. I was 7 years old, and my mom just whispered in my ear. She go, you know, telling me that she goes, nobody hits 400 this late into the season, and it was just an electric, the sky was blue. It was electric all the whole game, and I'll just never forget it, the sound of the crowd. Rod Carew came out for many, you know, he had to come out and tip his hat for many encores. That's what I remember. So that's mine.
It's an awesome story.
Exactly what
your mom in it. You just can't get any better than that.
Yeah.
I mean, in my opinion.
Right, Jim, you want to bat second this inning? You got your memory from the 70s?
Just to piggyback on Mike, when we were kids, Mike told me a story one time. He said, yeah, one time went out to the Twins game, and it was one of Harmon Killebrew's last days. And I remember the crack of the bat, the ball going up, and Harmon Killebrew, and that's the last thing I remember.
Yeah, I was sitting in right... Yeah, he's playing right field, and we're sitting in right field, and he came running back towards me, you know, following a hit, and then I must have been 3 or 4. That's all I can remember. I can't remember what happened next, but yeah.
The big story there is that I remember that. I remember that story.
Yeah.
I remember all of your stories. I don't know why. Probably because we were so competitive, you know.
Well, you're both good storytellers, or having led interesting lives, so.
Now, is this, do you want this to be a professional game?
No,
it's just a baseball story, anything.
Okay. T-ball, before we moved to Eagan, lived in Roseville, and we had a T-ball game up at North Heights School. And I was playing third base because I wanted to play either hot box or I just wanted to be in, either shortstop or third base. A ball came at me. I actually charged the ball. And it hit something, it came up and hit me right in the mouth. And I was never able ever to field the ball after that day without, Mike, you were probably at that when we used to play softball up there in Eagan off of Lexington.
Hill Park or whatever.
Yeah, and that Chuck guy would organize the games, and I got hit in the shins with softballs because they kept on throwing me at third base because it was so damn funny when I got hit in the shins. I ended up wearing my shin guards from soccer, and the ump was laughing at me. He goes, "How did that feel when that ball hit the same exact spot?" He said, "I could see the laces in your shin." So, that kind of thing. But the first memory was the baseball hitting me in the mouth, and it was just, that ended it forever.
Yeah, I can make you gun shy for the rest of your playing time.
Yeah, my life. If you came over as a guest and you took out your balled up socks and threw them at me, I would cower from them.
So, powerful memories from childhood.
Yes.
All right.
Okay.
So mine, and the reason I picked this as a topic, it was July 4th, 1978. My parents had made some friends during birthing classes before I was born, so we went with that family and my family to the Twins game, and they're gonna have entertainment after the game, and it was a gentleman by the name of Captain Dynamite, and he set himself up behind second base, and unbeknownst to the Twins, he put in a little bit extra oomph that time, and he set it off like he's gonna blow himself up, and he's supposed to pop up and wave to the crowd, and we'd all be happy. And there's a boom, and so I'm 8 years old, and I'm just staring at it, and nothing happens. He's just laying there, and it's like minutes go by. I look up. I can't remember if it's my mom or dad. Both of them will take credit for saying this, but I look up at them, and it's like, what happened? And they answer back, looks like Captain Dynamite blew it. So he eventually comes to and walks off the field, and he's dazed and everything. And when the pandemic hit, someone in the Minneapolis paper is just writing different stories. So I saw a story about him, and they gave him like $500 to do it. And then when he got knocked out or whatever, he basically knocked himself out from the extra blast, the traveling secretary or whatever, the Twins gave him an extra $100.
Wow. Sometimes it's worth it.
That was a lot of money in 78. But then it's like, that's always gotten me to thinking, like, if you could string together three or four sporting events you've been to, is there any other person, on Earth, it's also been to those same exact three sporting events. Like for me, it could be that Captain Dynamite game and then the Gophers football game where Darrell Thompson ran for 98-yard touchdown against Michigan. And then it could be, game six of the 1991 World Series. Were there three other people? Was there anybody else that went to those exact three sporting events?
I was at none of them, so...
Okay, well, I'll scratch you off the list.
Were you at the World Series game that you just mentioned?
Yes, I was at game six of the 1991 World Series where Kirby Puckett made the incredible catch up against the outfield glass, and then he hit the home run, and then my parents went to the game seven Jack Morris thing.
Oh, wow. I was – that game six, I was still at the academy, and I had to work late that night, and that was when I had transferred – down to the field, down to the airport, the landing field we had down there. And I'm inside the tower. We got all these little Cessnas coming in or whatever. And I'm watching the game on one of those, remember those TVs that were like this?
Yeah.
Like a Watchman or whatever. Watchman.
Exactly. Yep, that's exactly right. And I was in the tower and they were directing traffic behind me. And I'm watching the World Series game for that night. The next night I was home.
Cool.
Yeah, that was an amazing experience. It's outside of the purview of the 70s versus 80s, but that was one of my three favorite sporting events I've ever been to.
And that Jack Morris game, that's one of the best baseball games ever. I mean,
yeah.
And at the time they were saying that, and then over time the strength of that comment loses its luster. But I think it really stands as a, you know, what did he have, 11 innings? He started pitching.
I think it was 10 innings. You know, nowadays a pitcher going 5 innings is a big deal, especially in the World Series. And it was, I don't know if it was the 9th or 10th inning when Tom Kelly goes up to pull him. Says, Jack, you've gotten us this far. We're going to turn it over to the bullpen. And Jack Morris is like, no way. And Tom Kelly says he thought to himself, well, that's just the game.
Yeah. Well, and to it. And then when he went back up on the mound and he threw some pitches or whatever, and Kelly was kind of glaring at him out of the dugout, and you could see Jack Morris turning, and you could read his lips, no fucking way.
Yeah.
I remember, and that's the kind of guy that he was. He went to the elementary school I did out there, and they had a big picture of him on the mall.
Yeah,
he was not a nice person. You know,
wasn't. He was born May 16th, so like all May 16th people, myself included, he wasn't a nice person.
I'm a May 11th guy. I think if you were born in like an odd day in May, like 9/11,
you're okay.
Anyway, he was not a nice person. He wasn't really well-liked in the dugout, but he was there. He had a job, and everybody else, you know, you got your secretary, and you got your supply guy, and you got this. He's the pitcher, and he
So for the 4th inning, we're going to talk about the baseball movie The Natural, starring Robert Redford. For me, it was the first baseball movie I saw in the theater. And so I'll have Jim lead off this inning on, get started talking about Robert Redford in The Natural from 1984.
All right, so Robert Redford was my mother's absolute, I mean, to this day, she would leave our family, she would leave my dad in a heartbeat if, you know, he wouldn't even have to have that big boat with the pool table like in that movie with Demi Moore. And
decent proposal.
Yeah, he could come by in like one of those radio flyer wagons and shoot. My mom would be like, see ya. So she had this job. Mike might remember this. She had a job at JCPenney in Burnsville Mall. And right next to JCPenney, you'd walk out of the second floor, and there were the theaters there in Burnsville Center. And I saw that movie there at Burnsville Center in 1984, and I didn't understand it at the time, because I was watching the baseball part of it. I wasn't watching like the ethereal quality they were adding, where you know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
You know, and so I was watching it as a baseball movie, and then when I got to the Air Force Academy, and I was not a cadet. When I got to the Air Force Academy years later, my buddy there kind of explained to me what, you know, so I watched it again. But in the pantheon of baseball movies, gotta be in the, top three at least, right?
I think so.
With Bull Durham and, you know, what else? Like Tom Hanks one I didn't
there's
like.
Field of Dreams and, Eight Men Out, a couple other movies we're going to get to. It's 82% on Rotten Tomatoes, which surprised me it was that low. Although, I think the way it portrays women isn't necessarily the greatest. And I don't know if that has anything to do with it.
Guys, like, let me see here how much change you got in your pocket. Remember that?
Yeah.
That creeped me out right there.
See, the thing I remember from seeing it in the theater was, you know, he befriends the Bat Boy, helps, and the Bat Boy is kind of one of those kids who's like probably gets bullied and everything. He befriends the Bat Boy and helps him make his own bat. And so when that bat breaks, then he, of course, the kid, the Bat Boy, brings out the bat they made together to hand to him to hit the winning home run and everything. It's a tearjerker, but as a 14-year-old or whatever, playing baseball at the time, you eat that stuff up.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then she introduced him to his son, right? At some point in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
Because
Chris before he went off to
get
fame and fortune 16 years later.
Yeah. Now, I don't know who that actor was that played the kid. I don't know. You know, they paid some pretty big, you know, hitters to be in that movie, you know, with the, you know, Glenn, whatever her name is, Glenn Frey.
Glenn Close. Glenn Close was also in the Eagles.
Glenn Close, yeah. Glenn Close and Robert Redford and...
Well, even Robert Duvall had a small role in it.
Robert Duvall was in it. Wilford Brimley in it as his manager.
Okay. Yeah, so...
Yes, I think so.
Yeah.
I was too distracted because he was yelling at me about checking my blood sugar. But he was in that movie, I think.
Well, let me butt in.
Come on, you didn't get that, Mike?
Yeah, I got it. He was telling us, and he played Pop. He played Pop Fisher, Wilford Brimley, and as we mentioned, Robert Redford was in it. Robert Redford was 48 at the time of the shooting of the movie. Wilford Brimley was 50, 2 years older than Robert Redford.
They only look like they're three decades apart. So
yes, they do.
Great makeup, or
yep.
Wilford Brimley was leading a tougher life, and hence why he's got a...
Yeah, he was on checking his blood sugar back then. Yeah.
You check your blood sugar, and you check it often.
Well, it wasn't Wilford Brimley. He was in that movie where they jump in the pool and get younger. What movie was that?
Cocoon.
Yeah, but he was I think he was only in his 30s when he filmed that. I don't know, but he wasn't that old in that movie, but he played
old... I forgot about that movie. He was in The Firm. He played a great character in The Firm.
Mm-hmm.
The security, you know, for the law firm. But in that, you know, in that movie, yeah, he played Pop, right?
Pop Fisher, yep.
It was like, I should have been a farmer, or my parents wanted to be a farmer, and here I'm in baseball, and then Robert Redford, his character is like, my parents, I was always wanted to be a baseball player.
And then he said, you're the best I ever saw, which was a great... Great moment in that film. Great line.
Just one more tidbit to before we go. But like I said, my mother just was crazy about Robert Redford. And one day they used to have at JCPenney, they would bring in, I guess, motivational speakers and semi-famous people, whatever. And my mom saw a sign they were going to have Robert Redford come, and Robert Redford was going to speak. Or at this thing in JCPenney, and she went up to her shift, and she's selling all these things, and she came and looked at the sign more closely, and it said Roger Radford was going to be the guest speaker. And that is an inside joke to the family to this day. Dad says, well, maybe, let's pick out a movie, Mom, maybe Roger Radford.
So one thing under in the natural, they had the Chicago Cubs, you know, they had a bunch of the teams. Why did they make them be the New York Knights when they had actual, you know, the other teams they played against were real teams? That's kind of weird.
Steinbrenner been owning the Yankees by then and would have probably ixnayed it the same way that he wouldn't let his teams go to the Superstars competition like we talked about in a previous podcast.
Oh, that's a good point. That's a good point. Okay.
Steinbrenner was a dick about most things, I guess. Steinbrenner was Steinbrenner for 50 years.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, it was even bugging George Costanza in the 90s. So, all right. So, are we ready
Larry
for the...
David did that voice, by the way.
Yeah. So, we're going to transition from the fourth inning to the fifth inning. The Natural was based on a novel, a 1952 novel of the same name. And so, we're going to talk about some books that were turned into pretty good baseball movies. Okay. So the first of the three books turned into movies that were filmed in the 70s or 80s I wanted to talk about was Bang the Drum Slowly. The movie came out in 1973 based on this book of the same name that came out in 1956. And the basic synopsis of it is there's a journeyman, kind of slow-witted catcher who is befriended by the star pitcher, and then the catcher comes down with a terminal diagnosis for cancer, and it kind of as their situation evolves. The catcher's played by Robert De Niro, and Rotten Tomatoes has given it a 92% fresh rating, so it's a highly rated movie. It's kind of a tearjerker as opposed to a comedy.
For Bang Down Slowly, they're giving what are they giving it?
92% on Rotten Tomatoes for Bang Down Slowly.
How can a movie get 92% and a lot of people had never even heard of it.
I get it mixed up with Brian's song, to be perfectly honest.
Well, I was just telling him, Same thing when you got lost. I told you.
Yeah, when you went on your temporary vacation, we were talking about that, the Gail Sayers story, Brian Stone. It's very similar. It could be that it's from 1973, so really it wouldn't have been in our conscious back before VHS and things like that, where we would have been out of the theaters before and then just shown on TV.
That makes sense.
Didn't they make an adult remake of it? And then what was that title, Jim? Do you remember the title of that one?
Sorest Rump.
No. To bang the drum slowly, I thought you had one.
Bang my mom slowly?
Yeah, he sent me a text message, and so I replied back.
Like, yeah, that's what I was looking
Somebody
for.
Somebody asked me if I was going to be in a gay porn, what would it be called? And I said, Sorest Rump. That's what I can come up with.
And that's when your director yells at you. There's no crying in gay porn. No, just never mind. No. Okay. So what other besides that one?
Pick a title and something. And I say that's the name of my sex tape. So you could say yeah, bang the drum slowly. So the next one I had, and I wanted to touch base. I had taken in sophomore year in college during the J term, we had. Let's go over this again in case it wasn't caught on the first take before Mike went on his temporary
vacation. What's a J-term? Recording
equipment. So J-term was, so the first semester and second semester, they still had like 3 weeks of schooling they had to give you. So you had like a one-credit class during that 3 weeks, and you could pick whatever you want. So sophomore year, I picked literature and baseball, and it's one of my favorite classes I ever took. We read Bang the Drum Slowly. We read Shoeless Joe, which we're going to talk about.
That's a great class.
Later. And we read books, and we also watched movies, and so we watched Eight Men Out. So that's the second one I'm going to get into. The movie came out in 1988, so right in our wheelhouse, and the book was from 1963, and it's basically the tale of the Black Sox and throwing the 1919 World Series. And it had a decent cast. It had John Cusack, Charlie Sheen, D.B. Sweeney, Christopher Lloyd was in it, John Mahoney, so plenty of cast, and I thought it was a well done movie. Rotten Tomatoes has that one at 86%.
Wow, yeah, that's a good. I read that book. That's just a good story. It's hard to screw that story up because I think it's one of the American stories of the Chicago Black Sox scandal from 102 years ago now. Yep.
Well, and go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Well, and just we still think to this day it's like, oh, the NFL is wanting to make sure that Tom Brady wins, or you know, basketball wanted to get a title to this town, so then that's why Kevin Garnett went to Boston, or all these other things. And obviously it's because of this whole story, the Chicago Black Sox or White Sox story, where they threw pit players through the games, that we obviously think that could be feasible.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the thing about that movie is that you've got all that star power playing all these parts. And for me, when I watch a movie, I get distracted if there's too much star power in it. I want people that I've never seen before so that I can't make a judgment on that character based on what I know about that actor. So it's hard for me, but it's an undeniable movie, like Mike was saying, and I think that's one of Cusack's best roles.
Definitely.
You know, being the player that didn't take the buyout type thing, but punished nonetheless.
So I go down two paths with what you just said. A lot of these newer movies, like they have 8 or 9 or 10 stars in it. I can't think of any names, like, usually like there's one like for Valentine's Day or Christmas or stuff, and they've got even like Taylor Swift's in it and stuff like that. And that's just, you're right, you're so distracting, it's kind of disjointed. A movie like this, it was almost probably easy to get these guys, especially like Charlie Sheen with his love of baseball, to sign up to be in it because of the story, because they just wanted to be part of it, as opposed to getting unknowns to tell the story. These known actors probably even worked at a discounted rate to be part of this movie.
I mean, like the D.B. Sweeney character, that was perfect because D.B. Sweeney was a face that you had seen before, but he wasn't a big star at that point until, I mean, I don't think Sweeney was ever a huge star, even when he made that movie about the being taken up by a UFO. But to me, in that movie, that was a perfect character for me. But I know what you're saying.
Sweet. Okay.
All right. So then, did you have more on this one, Mike?
Nope. Go ahead.
You read the book. I don't think I read the book. Book. Even though we talked about how good the movie was the book like it usually is better?
Yeah, the book was. I don't know if I read that book. I read a book. It was told from the third baseman's point of view. I can't. His name escapes me right now. But yeah.
Tony Gwynn.
Yeah, Tony Gwynn.
I'm in an argument with a kid on YouTube right now because I think Tony Gwynn was the best hitter of his era. And he came back and he said, you think he was better than Babe Ruth and Ty Cobb and, you know, all these players. And I said, you can't compare, you know, a player from 1910 with a guy in 19, you know, but... You know, I mean, really from the batting perspective, if you're a hitter, all you're doing is putting, you know, the bat on a ball. And I said back then, they were throwing the ball 70, you know, miles an hour tops. And you take that batter and you put him in a time machine, and now you've got him playing in 1990 when they're throwing 100 miles an hour. You say that player is better than Tony Gwynn. So
all-time baseball players would be pretty good hitters now. The other thing that I think about when you think of Tony Gwynn or these Rod Carews, George Brett, Wade Boggs, all these people had a lot of hits or high average during that time. How many of their hits came, and I've stolen this from another podcast, but how many of their hits came in the sixth, seventh, or eighth inning off the starting pitcher, whereas nowadays it's the first reliever out of the bullpen, second reliever out of the bullpen. You know, you're seeing a pitcher for the third time, fourth time. You know, how many of their hits came then after they've seen the pitcher's tiring, as opposed to now you got, you know, the sixth inning specialist is in. Now it's the left-handed seventh inning specialist. Now we're going to the eighth inning, and we've got the setup man in the ninth inning as the closer.
I think that's a mistake. I mean, I really do, but you're absolutely right. I mean, you're getting you're looking at a fresh pitcher every inning or two, and, you know, you're absolutely right. I mean, the conversation I got into with this kid was strictly mechanics. You know, talking about mechanics, not who had the best average or who had the most home runs. We're talking about like swing mechanics.
Yeah, Ted Williams.
And and so
that's all you need. I'm done with my argument.
Yeah. What do you mean,
Ted Williams? That's the answer.
Oh yeah, and he said Ted Williams too, and I said, well, now there you've got a point. But in 1995. Ted Williams sat down with Bob Costas and told Bob Costas that Gwynn was a better hitter.
Yeah, I do remember seeing that. That was one of those things about Ted Williams. It's like you're lucky or you're blessed if you're able to be the best in the world at one thing. And he was the best in the world at three things, the guy said. Hitting a baseball, flying a jet, and fly fishing.
Flying a jet?
When he was in Korea, he flew a jet. He missed a season to be a pilot in Korea. He also missed during World War II, but he obviously wasn't flying jets then.
I remember that actually now.
He was an excellent pilot and had, you know, 16 or 18,
kills,
you know, kills. Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah. And, Elvis was his tail gunner.
Yeah. But, and then that's the thing too, when you look, his stats don't measure up, but he missed five seasons during what would have been the prime of his career, especially the ones in the, you know, after 41, when he hit 406, he missed 42, 43, 44, and 45.
Yeah, so,
I just noticed that in this podcast, we've mentioned Ted Williams, Carl Yastrzemski, and Jim Rice. So how many Boston Red Sox left fielders are left to mention before? I don't even know any other after that. But all right, so what other movies you got, Brian?
Oh, yep. Then the last one of the books was Field of Dreams. So that's based on the book Shoeless Joe by W.P. Kinsella. I read that one in that class. And movie came out in 1989. Basically, a guy wakes up one morning and he had a dream or something told him to go build a baseball field so that basically so he could go play catch with his dad, which is one of those things for those of us who still have our dads alive, you should, you know, say hi to him coming up or play catch with him when you get a chance.
Your dad want to have a catch?
Oh, yeah, exactly. And you know, I hope my kids do that to me someday, too.
Yeah.
The movie had Kevin Costner in it, and we're going to talk about another Kevin Costner movie coming up. It was Field of Dreams was 87% on Rotten Tomatoes. I thought it was a decent movie. It's a great story. The book is pretty good. I remember reading it. They even go up into Minnesota to find Moonlight Graham, and so being a homer, if you mentioned Minnesota, you got a little bit more interest from me. Do you guys have any thoughts on your reminiscence of Field of Dreams? It came out in 1989.
Go ahead, Mike.
It's crazy. We're going to have two Kevin Costner baseball movies, and I think we're going to have also talk to what's-his-face from 8 Men Out is on two movies, too, Charlie Sheen. Baseball movies, so...
That's right.
Yeah, we have a Charlie Sheen second act coming up, too.
No, I just, the only thing of Field of Dreams is I often mention the last scene whenever you see traffic in a weird spot. I go, this is like the ending of Field of Dreams where they have the traffic jam in the middle of Iowa. Yeah. So that's my whole thing with the movie.
I loved it. I loved it. I thought it was a great movie. I didn't think I was going to like it, and I loved it.
Yeah.
You know, you could look at it as a baseball movie, but then it also had that ethereal quality with, what's his name? The guy that played Darth Vader's voice.
James Earl Jones.
I mean, my God, you can't miss with him in a movie usually. So I love that movie.
Yeah. I like the movie. It's kind of got that Stephen King supernatural, but it doesn't really, you're not sure if it does or not. But it's like a happy, not like Stephen King where everything goes to hell. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
All right, so that'll segue us into the sixth inning. Sixth inning is going to be the movie Bull Durham with Kevin Costner, Susan Sarandon, Tim Robbins. That's going to also tie for the highest Rotten Tomatoes rating of the movies we're talking about tonight at 97%.
What movie is that?
Bull Durham.
Good Lord.
Yes.
Well, I mean, that was a great movie.
It's a good movie.
I don't know. Sports Illustrated one time ranked it the number one greatest sports movie of all time. The Arts Film Journal ranked it number 3 on the list of 25 greatest movies. I don't know. Out of all the movies we're going to talk about tonight, I think it's the one I would, if you said, let's go back and rewatch one, I think it'd be last place for me. I don't know. I mean, cause it was kind of a comedy drama. Would that be fair to call it a dramedy?
Yes.
And I think The Natural, of course, is 10 times better at the drama part. And then, you know, I think Major League is 10, 20 times better.
At the comedy.
So I mean, it was fine at the time. I liked it at the time. I don't know if I'd go back and rewatch it. You know, how about you guys? You guys disagree with me?
It's one of those movies that has like a million moments that you could pluck out of it.
As, yep.
You know, like when Costner runs the base after hitting the dinger and... Kiss My Butt, Joe Who, and, you know, little things you could pick out of the movie. As for...
Yeah, I think of the great, like, I like the line, Kevin Costner is playing catcher, and the guy pops up, and he's like, I don't think that one's going to have the distance. Like, he pops up to the catcher. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and as there were some things stolen or used in Major League that were from... Bull Durham, when they're having the meeting on the mound and they're trying to figure out what to get Millie for a wedding gift, and then someone can't perform unless he eats something, and it goes on like that. So like I think it's Robert Wool is the assistant manager, and he comes out and it's all right, well, the candlesticks is a good gift, and just starts listing off the stuff. They're like talking about anything about baseball during the whole meeting on the mound. Or then when he throws the bats into the shower. I don't think Sadik ever did that at Rosemount with the baseball team.
What's his name? Tim Robbins. Wasn't he wasn't his character Luke Lelouch or something like that?
Yeah. Luke Lelouch, yeah.
That was the first time I had seen him, and I think that's where he and Saran Wrap, you know, hooked up. But I thought, oh, dude, that guy is funny. And he ended up being breaking out of jail and climbing through a half mile of shit.
He played that wide-eyed rookie so well, as opposed to, and then Kevin Costner as the you know, road weary veteran who's respects the game and, you know, isn't gonna make the bigs ever, but this guy's gonna make the bigs just because he got lucky in the genetics department. So it's got so many different little subtails like that, which makes it might be part of why it's rated so high.
He comes in, he says, well, somebody gonna get laid tonight, or I don't remember what the line was, you know, and when Costner shows up for at Sarandon's house, and then Nuke shows up, and he's like, "Is somebody gonna get laid or what?"
My line, I always use it maybe once a week at work, is when he's like, when Costner's telling them how to handle the reporters, and he's like, just happy to be here, hope I can help the team. I say that at work all the time when somebody asks me how.
That's the mark of the movie, especially for the movies that we've talked about on the podcast, and the ones that you guys have talked about on the podcast that I don't get to guest on, is the lines that you can take away from them and still use to this day in everyday life.
Yep.
That's like when they, like, you want the day off tomorrow, and they're like, I'll get you a rain delay, and they go turn on the sprinklers in the field.
Okay.
Right. So I'm going to move us on to the seventh inning. So we did this for the 70s. We're going to do it for the 80s as well. So we're each going to share baseball memory from the 80s. And so I think I had Mike lead off that inning. So, Jim, I'll have you lead off this inning with the baseball memory from the 70s. Again, could be professional, could be Little League, could be high school.
It's got to be the Twins. I mean, you know, I mean, I don't know how anybody's personal moment could be any better than than a World Series in 87, worst to first. I mean, that was just a miracle. That was just a miracle, that team. And, you know, Kelly comes in.
Because my dad's a big baseball fan too, and when the Twins went to the series in 65, he was stationed in Alaska, so he didn't get to, you know, really keep pace with that. So everyone was all worried to make sure that he was able, you know, always getting to watch the Twins in the World Series, because that was the second time.
Yeah. I didn't even know that.
Yeah, 65, they lost in 7 games to the Dodgers. Colfax went on 2 days rest to beat him in Game 7.
Damn, I didn't even know that. Yep. Did you know that, Mike?
Yeah, it was Colfax got hot, and that was pretty much the thing that kept them from winning, yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
Colfax was unbeatable.
Got down Tony Oliva and Killebrew, Bob Allison, that team. Right, so Mike.
I'm sorry, one thing. My dad had met Oliva one time and shook hands with him, and he said that his hands were so huge from all the.
All right. So, Mike, you want to go second, or should I go second?
Yeah, I can go second because mine's pretty much this. For me, it's the 1987 World Series I was going to kind of talk about off. I just remember when they won it, you know, it was the first time in 22 years they had been in the – first time, you know, a Minnesota team had won anything. And I remember Chris Dunn in high school, I don't know, for some reason he had his mom's van, and we went and soaped it up, and I wrote – Super Bowl champs, go Twins, Super Bowl champs, because everybody's talking World Series. So I wrote Super Bowl champs to be funny. And then we graffitied it all up, and we went down to Minneapolis for the, went to the state capitol for the parade. And I remember there was just a bunch of pretty girls there, and we got like 8 of them jumped in the van with us when we were rolling, and they were like from the north suburbs, which seemed like a different country to us. And yep. So
it still is to this day.
Yeah, still is, and that. So I just remember that the parades and all the celebration and the craziness of it all. So
I took a car full. I drove a car full to the celebration, but I had my brother and sister with, so we couldn't get a bunch of girls from the north. I think I had like Eric Christensen and I don't know Chris Freeman and I don't know who else was with. But yeah, we stood way. I mean, you would way out on the Capitol grounds to that rally. That was packed.
Yep.
Remember the song that they would play, that song from
The Dirty Dancing? Now I've had the time of
my
life.
No, the when the Twins won, I'll think of it. I'll think of it. There was a couple of songs they kept on playing about the city. That band that kept on changing their name. I can't think of it. Oh, go ahead and go on. I'll think of it.
Okay, my memory isn't Game 7. I have a different memory, but I was lucky enough to get to go to Game 7. A classmate and then his sister and a friend of his sister's and I got to go. And the reason I got to go is because I had gotten tickets and let him come with to the playoff games. So then we're driving through Minneapolis after the game, and it's just everything's roaring and everyone's yelling, and these girls next to us, like, get our attention. They roll down the windows, like, they're playing We Are the Champions on KDWB, and the person I'm with is like, we only have an AM radio. So, but my memory I wanted to talk about, as soon as the Twins clinched, the playoff tickets were going to go on sale, or they were going to sell them at Ticketmaster, back when you had to actually go to a Ticketmaster, not like nowadays, you just get on your phone and do it. So my dad took off from work, went to the Ticketmaster at Burnsville Center, and the line was just incredibly long. And he's like, we're not going to get tickets, but he's going to wait it out. Well, then somebody, because you could also call in, somebody got through on a payphone to Ticketmaster, and they kept on feeding quarters into it, and they just would hand the phone to the next person in line. So he got 4 playoff tickets that way. We were in upper deck, right center field. And so we decided that my dad and brother and mom and my sister, so those 4 would go to the first playoff game, and I'd get to go to the second playoff game, and I could take 3 friends. So of course, then I actually had friends at school other than just you two guys, because you notice I didn't take either of you to it. So 4 of us went. So Mr. Myrie, the English teacher, also had playoff tickets, and so he's like talking about it, and he's like, if you know, and thinking that we're just gonna be watching it on TV, right? So if any of you students can see me at the game and tell me where I sat, I'll give you an A on the next quiz. Well, John Knight, the fabulous John Knight, was one of the people that came with me. And so between every pitch, between innings, he had binoculars and he was scanning, and he found him in like the second, like at the bottom of the 5th inning. He was sitting about 10 or 15 rows up down the third baseline. And so then we started writing down everything he was doing, what he was wearing, what the person next to him was wearing, the person behind him. Gary Guida made a great play. And so, you know, John Knight writes down, you really like Gary Gaetti's play in the 7th inning. You got a beer in the bottom of the 7th, all this stuff. And so we bring it to him at school the next day. And he's like, seriously, you guys saw all that? So what he did is he gave everybody an A on the next test. So we helped everyone out.
So what was the deal? He bet you that you wouldn't be able to see him?
He just said, if anybody can find me at the game, thinking that you'd only be able to see it when they show the crowd pictures, not that we would actually be there. And so we were upper deck right field, and it was like 55,000 people there. So John Knight dedicated to it. He was scanning. We finally found him. And so it was something that I remember to this day. And then also when we left, the elevator line was so long. And so it was Eric Christensen was another one that was with. So we just ran around the parking ramp, just, you know, up and up and up. And we beat people up there. And I wish. But so since I got that ticket, then the third person was able to, they got tickets for the Game 7, and so I got to go with because I got him tickets to go to the playoffs. So
awesome.
So that's my memory from the 80s. And then, yeah, of course, Game 7 was you can't top that. That's probably the best. And then the Kirby Puckett game would be my second best sports memory.
How about the Chuck Knoblauch play where he
where
he faked out the guy that he had fielded the ball and he held up? That was one of the best shortstop plays ever.
Mm-hmm. So for that game, we were four rows in front of the Jumbotron in left field. I mean, so we were way out there. You could hardly see anything. And we had Atlanta Braves fans behind us. We're watching it, and it was like Lonnie Smith or whoever, why is he kind of holding up there? He could easily make it to third, and then, nope, he stay at second and saved a run. And then when Puckett makes his catch, so there was a runner on first, and so this ball is just crushed, and it's like your runner's rounding second, and all of a sudden it's like, he must have caught that. Puckett must have caught that because the runner's heading back to first. That's the only way we could tell, because when everybody stood up, Kirby Puckett just disappeared into
a crowd of people,
and you couldn't tell if he caught it or not. And, of course, you can't see the Jumbotron that's behind you. They hadn't put in the one that was on the south side of the stadium yet. It was only the one on the north side. And I think I got a sunburn from it. So, but you were there, right?
Yeah.
That was terrible tickets.
It didn't matter. If you were there, you were a part of it. That's a great story to have, man, for your kids and all that. That's awesome.
Yeah. One song that's first and foremost, it's the only song that's been honored by the National Baseball Hall of Fame, Center Field by John Fogerty. But are there any other baseball songs you guys can think of?
I don't like that song, by the way. I don't. I just, Fogerty's kind of a dick.
You guys are talking about two different. Was it Talking Baseball or are you talking?
Well, there was that. I can't remember the guy who did it, like Talking Baseball, and then he started making for the team. So the one about the Twins was
Kirby, yeah.
Kirby, you know.
The Killer and Carew.
Killer and Carew, right. And then there was for New York, it was like Reggie. And so, yeah, that came out. That was probably what the mid 80s when those started coming out, too.
Yep. And then, the only other baseball song is Center Field by John Fogerty, like you said.
I'm just not a Fogerty guy.
Yeah.
I met him one time, and he was a dick, and then he was just a dick. Every time I saw him on TV, there was something he was fucking crying about, and I just thought, I wrote him off. I don't like it.
I think it's an okay song. It's you have to kind of be in a certain mood set to listen to it. I think it's very like the year it came out is kind of, I don't know. It seems dated for even though it should be timeless. I don't know why.
It's only good for like the next few days, really. It's the last week of March, the first week of April, where the snow's off the field and the sun came out. It's basically a celebration of spring happening and into summer and.
Yeah.
Yeah, as far as the song itself, it's nothing to write home about, but it's the subject matter that brings it home to, when we're talking about songs about baseball.
And songs about baseball, I don't think about songs. I think about moments where baseball enters into songs. And I think the greatest one of all time, maybe one of the greatest Americana songs ever is Mrs. Robinson, Simon and Garfunkel, where he's like, "Where have you gone, Joe DiMaggio? Our nation turns its lonely eyes to you." And then he says, "Jolton Joe is gone." And
I don't know where you pulled that out, Mike, but wherever you got that, that was a good pull out because that's an awesome song.
Yeah. I just think that's one of the greatest lines in Americana history. And then the only other baseball I can think of, me and Jim are Springsteen fans. It's not one of his greatest songs, but "Glory Days" were. He's talking to his friend that can throw that speedball by you. It starts with a baseball line, which is kind of ironic because Springsteen doesn't really know anything about sports. He even admits that. But...
I know. Oh, that's funny.
All right, so we're going to move on to the eighth inning. The eighth inning is maybe the best baseball comedy of all time. Major League from 1989. 83% rating on Rotten Tomatoes. But it's, for me, the baseball line that I probably use a half dozen or more lines from this movie in my daily life.
I like the movie. I wasn't crazy about it. I probably saw it a couple of times, but this isn't going to be a good one for me to get a lot of thoughts on because it wasn't my favorite. I like the guy that said he reminded me of Leon Durham, the guy that said kiss my butt, Joe Boo, or whatever. Yeah. I don't remember. But I was just kind of so with it.
All right, so basically we'll just put a designated hitter for you for this inning, and Mike and I'll talk about it for a little bit, and we'll pick you up.
It's a quick out for me.
So for me, this movie is like it's amazing because like Corbin Bernstein played third base. Willie Mays Hayes by Wesley Snipes played center field. I mean, there's no other baseball movie where I can name the lineup. I can name almost the whole lineup. They had the old starting pitcher. They had Charlie Sheen as the young starting pitcher, up and coming. And then they, I forget what Jobu, was he the designated hitter or was he an outfielder?
Or I think it was like a left or right fielder. Yeah. Dennis Haysbert, who now does those Allstate commercials.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's weird. It's like, I can almost name the whole starting lineup. And then what's his face from Platoon is the catcher, you know, kind of that we see the movie through his eyes,
He's Tom
Berenger. Yeah.
The story. So for me, and I played it, my daughter played a lot of softball through the years. And so she's about 14 or 15 when I first had her watch it. And she just, the whole, you know, we talked about montages with Rocky, the training camp montage of just their terrible team and missing throws and balls falling in between them and popping up and doing the push-ups. That was about the funniest thing she had seen. It goes so well with, if you've played the game a lot, those things that they send up. Even at the start when they're trying to get together a team that's bad enough so they can leave. So they got the, the showgirl owner. And so they're inviting these people, and the brain trust is like, who are these guys? Half of them, I don't even know who they are. And so a lot of them never had primes or anything. And then the one of the brain trust says, this guy's dead. And so real sassily, the showgirl says, well, then scratch him off. And it's like, I'll use that line as it's just when something is like, you know, oh, that shouldn't be on the list. We'll scratch it off. We watched it so much with my group of friends in the early 90s. That we had a drinking game with it where you'd pick a character, and then if you didn't get their line correct when it would come up in the movie, you'd have to take a drink. That's probably the last time I was really drunk. Would have been about 93 or 94. I picked Lou Brown, the manager, and, you know, Tire World, and Lou Brown, it's, you know, Charlie with the Cleveland Indians. You want to manage the Indians this year? He's like, oh, I don't know. I'll think about it. I got a guy on the other line about some white walls. So he's like working in a tire shop or something. And so that part of that is how you get to a movie that much. You watch it so much, you probably like it more than you should or that it's worthy of. But this is one of those movies for me. I don't know if I could do all his lines anymore, but like when Corbin Bernstein comes up to him, it's like, that's specifically in my contract that I don't have to do any unnecessary calisthenics, and Lou Brown basically unzips and, you know, pisses on it.
You can hear the urination hitting the contract, yeah.
it's pretty funny. It's well done. It wasn't rated as high as Bull Durham, but like I said, there's some obvious send-ups of things from Bull Durham in here that they just took to another level.
Yeah, I didn't realize those movies only came out a year apart because Bull Durham was 88 and this was 89.
Yeah, I remember seeing Bull Durham the summer in the theater the summer between high school and college, and then I didn't actually see Major League until like second or third run movies when they start to go to the cheap theaters. They'd show them at St. John's at the and that, you know, the auditorium. So that's where I first saw it. You know, they're trying to get them to loose. They get them a crappy plane. The guy's out like duct taping the wing, and then they end up on a tour bus, and just it's just. It's well done as a comedy, you know, to me, and maybe it's just because of the, you know, subject matter. Obviously, you guys let me run with this episode because I'm such a baseball fan that, you know, if it was about, you know, ice dancing or ballet or and it had the same, you know, types of humor, I probably wouldn't find it as funny.
And then what I was really impressed with is the choreography, if I can believe I'm going to say that. But they have the slow motion where Tom Berenger's character bunts instead of, you know, he points that he's going to hit a home run like Babe Ruth, and then he bunts, and that and then the third baseman, you see him go, oh shit, and he like in slow motion and he starts and it's choreographed just perfect. Like they have all the players like in the right spot and doing usually like we've talked about this before how they screw up sports movies where they have like a football player break 100 tackles and it's like, well, why did they have 100 defenders on the field? So it's easy to screw that stuff up, but I thought they did the choreography pretty good on this. I don't know.
Well, they foreshadow that scene because when Tom Berenger's character, because he was in the Mexican League and he flunked out of that and he thought his life was over, and now he's back in the bigs and they're going to bring camp, he's going to make it, and they like first get to the stadium, he's out in the stadium alone, he does that whole thing, he points to the outfield, swings, runs the bases. He thinks he's in the stadium empty, and then the Charlie Sheen, the Wesley Snipes characters, Willie Mays Hayes and Rick Vaughn are there watching him, and it's like it comes back at the end, and then he's like does that, you know, I'm gonna point to the thing, make everything, I'm gonna try to hit a home run, and I'm gonna bunt and surprise everyone, and you know, score from second. So it's an interesting.
Is that the one where Charlie Sheen had the haircut and everybody was coming with the mullet and all that stuff?
Yep.
Who does your hair?
I forgot about that. Genetic. That's pretty. Yeah, maybe this deserves another look by me, and maybe I just didn't get.
Yeah, and he had the black nerdy glasses because he couldn't see, and then then he had the skulls on his glasses, and.
I thought that was kind of a wave to a Slapshot. In my opinion,
I'm with you there. Homage to another sports.
Yeah, I really think that was. I don't know if anybody would admit that, but I think it was.
And then, yeah, the whole Pedro Serrano subplot from when he first sees Corbin Burston. And Corbin Burston's got his golf clubs with, so it's obviously making fun of people who are just getting a paycheck and not really. And he's like, hats for bats. Keep bats warm. And he takes like one of the head. So that's one of those things, too, where it's like hats for bats. Anytime you see head covers.
That's the guy that reminded me of Leon Durham. He was just kind of built kind of like him and had the, you know, the goatee like him, like Leon Durham had when he was with the Cubs. And it just kind of made me kind of think of that.
They're showing him in the locker room. He's just shaving with a big, you know, fishing knife.
And then, hey,
we forgot to talk about Harry Carey because he's a big part of baseball, too. I mean, and we'd all, you know, like in the summertime, WGN would be on and we'd watch Cubs games all the year long or all summer long. At least I did, anyway.
Well, Bob Uecker is like a big part of this movie, kind of playing like a Harry Carey role, and he kind of steals.
Uecker was a natural, I think.
Just a bit outside.
Yeah.
Because I think prior to this, all he did was those advertisements. I don't think he was on Mr. Belvedere yet, or was he?
I don't remember. But that's talking about takeaway lines. You know, just a bit outside.
Tries the corner and misses.
A couple times a week still.
Yeah, and I use the one where he talks to so he's the announcer and then the color guy, and he asks the color guy, and the guy's just like, he's like, yeah, they're playing pretty good. And he's like, he's not the best color guy in the game for nothing, folks.
Oh, he was a funny guy, Bob Uecker was.
Yeah, those two, that's so much.
And quickly, Bob Uecker, alive or dead? Is he alive or dead right now? Quickly, answer quick.
He's alive.
Yep. I think he's 89 years old.
Still alive?
He's still alive, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm going to write him a letter.
So the beer commercial, you know, because they all did those Miller Lite ones. And so, of course, he was the, you know,
yeah.
you know, hit 200 or whatever, just nobody catcher, but obviously had this big personality. And so when he's sitting and talking to the guy, it's like, and then the usher comes up, Mr. Euchre, come with us. And he's like, oh, I must be in the front row.
Yeah.
And then they show him, and he's like second, he's like basically at seats worse than my 1991 World Series tickets.
Yep.
And the one scene like I really like is when Jabu's got his little voodoo stuff and he's like, don't drink Jabu's. And then the old pitcher's like, oh, well, he goes up there and he goes, we'll see about that. And he drinks it. And then
he goes out on the field.
He goes out, right? He's way out in left field. And then the batter lets, like we were talking about, he does the Tony Gwynn where he throws the bat.
Right. And before that, as he's walking out, he's like, hey, bartender, Jobu needs a refill. And then you see the bat swirling through the air and it hits him on the back of the head. It's like, that's just so well done.
Yeah, it's just great.
Remember the pitcher? Was that
jalapeno up your nose?
Yeah.
Yeah. The Vagisil. Was that this movie, the Vagisil?
Yes, it was. I don't have a young arm. An arm like you. You got to put anything you can. He's like, sometimes I'll stuff a jalapeno up my nose and rub a little. And Charlie Sheen is like, you put snot on the ball? Hey.
Yeah, whatever works.
All right. So, yeah, anything else about Major League you guys got?
Just the Jim should watch it again.
I will.
It's your homework. So we're going to go into the ninth inning. This is for the people in New Zealand. We're going to bring some little local flavor. So during our lifetime, we've had now three stadiums for the Twins. But the first one was outdoors, the Met. We talked about Mike and I had memories from being at games there. It was the Twins' home until 1990 or 1981, so from 61 when they started to 81. Mm-hmm. Then they moved to the Metrodome, mm-hmm. and that's where they had their best success. They had the World Series in 87 and 91, but it wasn't the best place to watch. I mean, it's probably better than the Astrodome, but it wasn't the best place to watch baseball, especially if you went there before air conditioning. It was terrible. We went to a game in 82, and it was just terrible.
I don't even remember that.
Yeah, I think. And wow. Did they hit a lot of home runs without the air conditioning, maybe?
I don't know, because that team had, you know, they started to have then Herbeck and I don't know if Gaetti was on that team. They started to have some better players, so maybe the home
runs went up. Tom Bernanski?
Yeah, he was coming in at that time. My memory of outdoor baseball versus indoor baseball is, like we said, was at the Met, so I would go when I was 11 years old, 7, 11, in that age. And then we had indoor baseball, and that went until 2010, right?
2009, I think, was the last season there. And then
So then in 2010, I went to a Twins game outdoors, and that was the first outdoor game I had been to in a pro game in 30 years. And then for whatever reason, 2 weeks later, I went to Boston and we got tickets above the Green Monster. So I went from the newest stadium in the time to the oldest stadium, and I saw an outdoor game twice in a row or within 2 weeks when I hadn't gone to one in 31 years. So that's kind of my weird memory.
The last time that I was at Met Stadium Met Stadium was for a Kicks game.
Wow.
That was in like, what year was that? 80 77. Or so? There was a baseball strike.
It had to be, well, it was before 1984 because my sister's boyfriend took me to that game and they didn't start seeing each other until 84. So it was right in that time frame.
That was, yeah, that was a lot of, that was crazier than rock concerts at those Kicks game, at those pro soccer games. They were a lot of marijuana and stuff.
All you had to do is bring a Wheaties box or some bullshit. I don't remember what it was, but that was the last time I was there that I can remember. So.
Wow.
Yeah, I can't remember the last baseball game that I saw at the Met. I never saw a Vikings game. We did go to a Kicks game.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, we had one summer we had a kid come over from Northern Ireland because it was, you know, all the different terrorism and everything like that. So it was a Protestant kid from Northern Ireland came stayed with the Catholics in Minnesota. And so they're big, obviously, into soccer or you know, football to them. And so we took him to a Kicks game. Well, we wanted to take him to a Twins game. The baseball was on strike that summer.
Oh, shit, yeah.
But I can't remember the last time I went to it, but I'd gone to some Saints games, so that's not pro, like the Twin, you know, Major League. But I hadn't been to an outdoor baseball game then until 2018, just because life throws curveballs. I didn't get to a Twins game from... I went to the last year at the Metrodome, my daughter sang for the Pine Hill where she went to elementary school choir, so she got to sing the national anthem. So that was the last year at the Metrodome, and that had been one of the last times I went. And then for whatever reason, I didn't get to a game again until April of 2018 when they had U of M night there, and we went. So my dad's not necessarily a fan of outdoor baseball just because of the weather and stuff like that. He wants to make sure there's not going to be a rain delay. So he was a fan of the Metrodome, but I mean,
I can't even imagine that being
we're
like
cooped
being
up inside in this state for at least 6 months of the year. So if you're gonna, you know, a nice summer afternoon or summer night, there's nothing better than being outside watching a game. Now that game we went to was April 28th. That's the one where the Reds beat the Twins like 14-5. We stayed to the bitter end. We did the old outdoor baseball thing of because the crowd goes home because it's getting cold. We started out in like the second or third deck, and by the ninth inning when the Twins are not mounting a rally to come back, we're like three or four rows behind the dugout. In fact, if it would have went to extra innings, they might ask one of us to pitch.
Yeah.
But you know, it kept moving down and getting closer. And then it was one of those times I've never gotten a foul ball in all my games that I've gone to. Or caught a home run ball or anything like that. And all of a sudden there's a foul ball. And it's like the next section over. And I start running towards it. I'm thinking if I ever got one now, I'd probably find the youngest kid I could find and just hand it to him, right? So I'm starting to like, I'm going to go get it. It'll be my first foul ball ever. And then a little bit ahead of me, there's this little maybe 5-year-old running, 6-year-old running. First of all, you know, it's almost midnight. Why is he still there? But secondly, it's like, well, I'm not going to run past this kid to get the foul ball. I'm not that kind of person. So I just stopped and let him have it. So never had a foul ball.
Batting practice. And I was thinking of you, Munson. I was thinking about you when I ran down there because it would have been fun to have somebody my age with me. But went down to watch batting practice, and it was Manny Trio. Remember Manny Trio? Cubs? Manny Trio, anyone?
Yeah.
Anyone? Okay. So he was warming up and taking swings, and when he got done – he turned around, there was all these kids, you know, and I was one of them. And he said, pick the number between whatever it was, whatever. And people are yelling out numbers. And, you know, he was from Mexico or whatever. So he spoke Spanish, and nobody had said his number yet. So I said, you know, cuatro, whatever the fuck his number was. And he went right at me, and he gave me his bat. So we're living in Minnesota at the time, and we're just down there for my dad to play golf and shit. So he goes, I know what I'll do. And he took that bat and he stuck it into his golf bag. You know, wrapped it all up and brought it back to Minnesota. And then next time you were over, Munson, you held that bat.
Wow.
Yeah, you held that bat. We had it in the garage over there in Eagan. And then what was the other story? Oh, the other story I can tell was when I was in Colorado and I was stationed at the academy. I was not a cadet. We went to see the Colorado Springs Sky Sox, and they were for the White Sox or whatever. And we get down there, and I said to my wife or whatever at the time, I said, I'm going to go down and watch batting practice. So I ran down, I'm 22 years old or whatever, and Albert Bell was over there, you know, just pounding balls. Like, it was amazing. But he was the biggest dick ever in the, you know, play baseball. Albert Bell was just an asshole. And so he gets done batting, and there's all these, you know, people, and I was probably the youngest one. And he turns around, and I said, hey, can I have your bat? And he looked at me, and he says, how much you got in your pocket? And I said, forget it. I don't even want it. And that was the end of that. He was a dick. He was.
He almost got kicked out for fighting. I don't know. Was that what it was?
He was suspended, I think, for behavior a couple
of times. Yeah, and drugs and all kinds of stuff.
Well, I got one quick story here. Is Jim, me and Jim, we used to hang out at Schindler's with the baseball cards all the time. And for some reason, we were going to go to Twins Fest. And the Twins Fest is where the winter thing where you'd go and you'd meet all the famous players. And we went out, we had to work or something, so we ended up going on the last day. And we'd see what famous players, there's only one player left, and it was their third starter. And we're like, who wants to see the third starter? Patrick Mahomes. Who the hell's Patrick Mahomes? Patrick Mahomes is nobody.
Yes!
We were mad because we're going to go see Patrick Mahomes, and that was all they had. So that's my little story, but because we thought we'd never hear that name again, right? Well, you'll never hear the name Patrick.
No, he's a pitched a couple seasons for the Twins and had a kid that was. There's a cute picture of him in a Twins uniform, but I don't think that kid's going to amount to much.
Yep.
I just have two things. I kind of want to say a post game show we're going to talk about has baseball changed for better or worse since the 70s and the 80s, but we kind of touched on that where sports has kind of been ruined by. It's more corporate, more big money nowadays, and not the, they're not going to have Captain Dynamite or Rod Carew Day and give away an actually good jersey. I mean, they used to give away full-size bats at Bat Day, and they don't do anything like that anymore.
Yeah. Well, my whole point on that is just I think we were the first generation where baseball wasn't number one, because I think by the 70s, the NFL had taken over as number one. But we were also the last generation, I think, that went and played baseball in our backyard, played tennis ball, baseball, or wiffle ball. Do you ever see kids? Have you ever driven by a baseball diamond and seen kids out there just playing? I mean,
without a parent there and they're pitching to them, or they've got the bow net set up and they got a pitching machine and they got cones out and they got, practice ball. And it's just, you don't see just kids just together playing anymore. Which reminds
we can't hear Jim. Let's say something. Say
The 1950s baseball movie about the kids.
The Sandlot?
Sandlot. That was a great movie. How did we not touch on that?
Because I was the one setting this up and I only had so much time to research.
No, but I mean, but all of them made a lot of movies.
Yeah.
I gotta go pretty soon. It's getting late.
Okay.
Okay. I got one baseball memory, then I'm gonna do a quick trivia question. The first listener that goes to the Facebook page after Mike or Jim posts this on Facebook and answers a trivia question, next time I'm on as a guest, I'll drop your name into the podcast. So that's the best prize I can give you. I know I touched on this the first time I guessed with you guys, but it didn't make the final cut. The last day of senior year of high school, we got out early. We all went, we got grills. We went to Goat Hill Park in Eagan. We started grilling stuff. We're going to play baseball. We had probably 25, 30 people there, I'm thinking. And we had a gas grill going, but we also had a charcoal grill. Mike and I were standing there lighting it. And Mike's just, no amount of lighter fluid is enough for Mike Munson. And he just douses it. And then throws a match on it, and it's just like when you watch explosions on TV and you hear that noise, that whoosh,
yep, that whoosh, yep.
And the flame curls out, and my leg hair grew back in a week. How long did it take for yours to grow back, Mike?
I'm still waiting. Yeah, I just remember hearing that immense heat, and boy, that wasn't good.
I was there with Beard. I don't remember that part, but I was there with Matt Beard. We showed up late. We got out of the train.
You missed the pregame show. Captain Mike Munson Dynamite went and tried to set himself on fire.
Well, it made that. It actually made that noise, though. That noise. It made that noise. Yeah.
It is a scary noise. So the trivia question is, what are the two northernmost cities to host a World Series game? So the first person to get that answer correct, next time I'm a guest on this podcast, I will probably mispronounce your name, but hey, at least you're getting mentioned on the Fastest Rising 70s versus 80s podcast in New Zealand. The man and Bobby Fella, the scooter, the barber and the nuke. They knew them all from Boston to Dubuque, especially Willie, Mickey, and the Duke. Well, Casey was winning,
Hank Aaron was beginning. One Robbie going out, one coming in. Kiner and Midget Goodell, the Thumper and Mel Parnell, and Ike was the only one winning down in Washington. I'm talking baseball. Klazuski came.